Welcome to Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine. I'm John Lawson. My guests today are my colleague Tess Berry and our interviewee Celeste Gainey. Welcome, Tess and Celeste.
Thanks, John. Thanks
Happy
for having me.
Happy to be here.
Celeste Gainey, where do I start in introducing you? Let's start by saying that you're here today primarily to read and talk about some of the poems from your first full-length poetry collection, The Gaffer, published by Arctoid Books. But you've also had a long career in movies, which is where your book's title, The Gaffer, comes from. You were the first woman to be admitted to the Motion Picture Industry Union, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. You worked on dozens of documentaries, feature films such as Taxi Driver and The Wiz, and TV shows including 60 Minutes and 2020. And then you opened your own lighting design and consulting company, designing lighting systems for restaurants, offices, retail stores, and museums in New York and LA, and probably all over the place. You've won numerous awards for your work in light, the GE Edison Award among them. You've served as president of New York Women in Film and Television. And now to top it all off, you've earned an MFA in creative writing poetry from Pittsburgh's own Carlo University and published this new poetry collection. But here's the latest news about you, Celeste. Your new book, The Gaffer, is about to be featured in Oprah's magazine, O. Your book will be featured in the reading room section of the April issue of the magazine, as well as on its iPad app. The issue goes on sale on March 17th, my birthday. Congratulations.
Happy birthday.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, John, and happy birthday to you. I like to tell people that I've gone for the money late in life by turning to poetry.
Yeah, obviously. Well, I want to get to your poetry real quickly, but before we do, tell me, how did you happen to come to Pittsburgh after that international sort of career?
I know, it's quite something. I had never been to Pittsburgh before my experience with the Carlo MFA program. And I think I was one of those individuals that came through that tunnel and just was gobsmacked by what I saw. And the skyline, the rivers, the bridges, the light. So I was immediately drawn visually to the city once I'd come here to study. And then as I spent more time here and I got to know people and I got to observe what I felt was going on in the city, a deep sense of community, I felt, which was something that I think is missing from a lot of places today. This all made me come to understand that Pittsburgh was someplace special. And I was living with my partner, who's also a writer, at the end of Long Island. And we were beginning to feel that there wasn't much happening out there for us anymore. So once Pittsburgh started to really resonate with me, I convinced Elise to come and to Pittsburgh and visit, and we decided, hey, we're just going to pull up stakes and move here. And it's been a terrific move because there is such a vibrant, wonderful writing community here and so many universities. So
I agree. Yeah. I'm an outlander myself.
Yeah.
I'm so happy to be here with Celeste and with you, John. I think listening to you talk about Pittsburgh, Celeste, I'm struck by the fact that place features prominently in your work. And having lived in such sort of iconic places, I'd like to know, for instance, growing up in Santa Barbara, just outside of L.A., and having seen L.A. From a certain period of in history, having a real sense of that, how the West figures or has influenced your work?
Well, a lot of people ask me what growing up in California was like. They always say to me, don't you miss California? And I tell them, well, I miss it even when I'm living there, because I'm from a geographic state called California, but I'm also from the California that is a state of mind. And this is something that I think, especially someone who grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in California, there are such iconic experiences that the entire country identifies with. we're thinking of the Beach Boys. We're thinking of, think of the song California Dreamin'. Think of the fantastic music artists that all swarmed around Laurel Canyon and the Troubadour. So much about that time has to do with California and or New York. And I happen to be in both places, so very, very lucky. But it does figure a great deal in my writing because it's my home. But I'm always trying, I think, in my poetry to kind of redefine what that means, redefine home, and find it again. Because like I said, I'm always missing it even when I'm there, because there's something elusive. There's something elusive about California that has nothing to do with its exact geography.
Yeah, I like that. And the idea of home also as being a sort of elusive, you know, thinking about this, an iconic saying like, you can't go home again. And the idea of home as not necessarily a kind of concrete place, but something we carry with us.
Right. And, you know, it's funny that you say you can't go home again, because I'm thinking of Patricia Hampl, who's the wonderful memoirist and poet. And she once said to us in our Carlo MFA program when she came to speak, you can go home again, and that is where you're going to understand everything from. So I think even though we're talking about this illusory concept, I am always drawn to go home and to examine things from that perspective. So that's what kind of, that's my relationship with California, I think, and my poetry.
Wonderful, wonderful. Can we hear some of your poetry?
Sure. I think the book The Gaffer is really, to say that it's autobiographical is not really accurate. I think that certainly it is of me and of my experience, but I think in this book what I've done is really created a persona, and it's really a persona that deals with certain things, deals with the notion of identity, and particularly gender identity. I'm gay, and so that's something that enters into this book. There's a lot of reference to clothing in the book, really more or less as a symbol or a metaphor for that searching for identity, the trying on of different types of clothes. At any rate, I'm going to start just by talking. The other thing I talk a great deal about, of course, in the book is my experience in the film industry. And again, not my specific experience, but the experience of the gaffer. So I'm going to start out with a poem called Best Boy. And the best boy is the assistant to the gaffer on a movie set. And the gaffer is the chief lighting technician. And usually if you look at the credits as they roll at the end of a feature film, you'll notice that there will be a credit for the gaffer, and there'll be a credit for the best boy, and then there will be electricians. And I have functioned in all of those positions. So this poem is called Best Boy. The chief assistant to the gaffer on a movie or television set, there are no best girls per se. And that's taken from the IMDb glossary. At the age of 3, I tell my mother, when I grow up, I'm going to be a man, like Pancho in The Cisco Kid, high-heeled boots, a six-shooter. Halloween, I'm a pirate with a hook. In the Christmas pageant, I insist on the Nutcracker or Mouse King, never Marie. Eighth grade, girls talk. Who will get married, make a good mother? Not one can see me as a wife with kids. It hurts a little to hear I'm not like them. I'm a boy in a kilt and knee socks. When I grow up, I'm going to play the field. In high school, I meet a boy I either love or want to be. He wears Madras shorts, crosses his legs elegantly, holds his Winston like a lady. One day, in a crowded elevator, as a joke, he yells, "Screw, screw, screw. All you ever want to do is screw. Who do you think I am, Superman?" "No," I say, "I'm Superman. You're Lois Lane." Just out of film school, I apply for a membership in the union. All the local 52 boss wants to know, can I carry horse cock, same as any man? All I want to know, will he let me join his band of brothers? Be best boy, apprentice to Vinnie Delaney, Milty Moschlack, Dusty Wallace, Dickie Quinlan. Set their spider boxes, haul their four-aught, flag their barn doors, trim their brute arcs, run their stingers, scrim their broads, wrap their nine light fays. Let them make me a man. So I should have said in the before we began that the horsecock reference is a reference to the largest cable that you can carry on a film set. And that was all that the that any of these union gentlemen seemed to be concerned with in the beginning, was not whether I knew how to light, but whether I could carry the heaviest piece of equipment. And in fact, when I started out in the business, and for instance, I worked at the networks and I started out shooting news with a crew. They would park as far away as they could in the beginning from a location because I had the heaviest case to carry. And so that I would, you know, I would have to prove myself or they would prove that I couldn't do that part of the job.
And obviously you succeeded in proving yourself.
I did. I wish I'd had wheels, but you know, those didn't exist in those days. And if they did, I would have been, you know, I would have really been spurned for using wheels.
And I love this sort of the metaphor of having to carry the weight of that, right? Because yeah. Identity itself is a kind of weight, right? So I'm interested in hearing, and we certainly want to hear some more poetry from you, but the idea of identifying as a queer writer, whether or not you identify as a queer writer, and what that means to you, and what you see as that in terms of a role for the writer in terms of social and cultural change.
Well, I do identify as a queer writer, and it's interesting. I don't really see it, though, as my choice. I think that I am queer, so it is something that I am, and it's a great part of my experience, being an outsider, because that's really, I really sort of view being queer as being sort of the preeminent, you know, domain of the outsider, and I relish that and cherish it. I'm not that interested in being absorbed into the mainstream completely. I love being able, the purvey of being on the outside of kind of the mainstream of society and being able to peer in. So I think for me, one thing that I get out of being identified as a queer writer is that vantage point. And that's something that just came to me through my DNA at birth, that I feel somehow different. And I'm sure every individual in this world probably feels in some way different, but I am biologically different. And so I think that gives me a particular point of view. And I also think that we're all creatures of our time, and all we can do is really write in response to our time. That's really what we're here to do and what we know. And my time was really a time of foment, at least my formative years. It has continued to be a time of foment for anybody who is, you know, identifies as homosexual or feels themselves homosexual. You know, I arrived in New York right at the end of the whole Stonewall conflagration. So there was a lot going on and has continued to go on in the years since. So a great deal of what I write about, I think, just naturally has that kind of point of view or that edge in there.
Right, which is great because it's pushing at the sort of idea of the writer as the outsider to begin with, right? The writer as being somehow able to observe. There's a heightened sense of that, I think. Right. Which is wonderful, and I feel that in your poetry.
Well, what's striking about this topic to me is that you don't use that outsider identity as an excuse for sitting on the sidelines. You observe in a kind of detached way, but you also were the first woman in the union. You know, you throw yourself into that adverse situation and you take it on.
Yeah, you're right. I think that that's, I don't know, maybe that's my Aquarian.
It's remarkable. Birthright. It is. It's remarkable.
Well, I think that it's, I mean, I'm a risk taker, I think. So I think that that is, that's something about me. And I also think that in terms of, let's say, the whole idea of lighting and becoming a gaffer, it wasn't something that chose me. I mean, that I chose, it chose me. So I often think, well, should I have been more, you know, should I have been more proactive? And let's say, you know, if I wanted to produce and direct, should I have pushed myself more in those directions? But really, lighting came and tapped me on the shoulder. And because I graduated at a time where I was sort of pushed out into this vortex of second wave feminism, and there was so much going on at the time, where institutions were being asked to hire women in non-traditional roles. I was just there, it was happening. All of that was happening around me. I would have been a fool kind of to not kind of follow, you know, that lead that was there for me. I think very different from growing up now or coming into the world now where there are so little opportunities like that or openings. You know, it's a completely different world, I think, for young people. But there was so much going on in New York at that time, and it just seemed that one thing followed another, and that's the field that I ended up going into.
So many interesting strains of thought here, but I don't want to get too far away from the poetry.
Let's have a New York poem then, and this is a lot about this poem is a lot about identity, and it's called "In the Days of Early Polyester." In the days of early polyester, you don't know yet you are flammable. Jars of Miracle Whip, tubs of poly-O in the fridge, your moral imperative on ice, the vertical blinds rattling shut, sleek sofa of solid kerosene, resisting your body's impression. You keep saying, cotton, cotton, the touch, the feel of cotton, but you are drawn to the slinky boy shirt with the Kandinsky-like print. Fancy your stubbled sideburns whiskering the top of its Byron-esque collar, long points gesturing toward no boobs torso, slim hips, bell-bottomed legs, fry boots. It feels like Velveeta against your skin, something you might scrape off with the blade of your Swiss Army knife. It seems to reject you. Still, you can't stop parading your shirt through Washington Square Park in the hot afternoon sun, looking for combustion.
That's great. I love that. That was wonderful. Can you say a little more about New York, which is a place you probably spent almost as much time as you did in California, and how that influenced you as an artist and a writer?
Well, I was taken to New York at the age of 15 for the first time, and I stepped off the plane, and I just felt, this is where I belong. I felt I was sent down the wrong chute, you know, something like that. So I got back to New York as quickly as I could, and that was for university, and I felt I identified completely with New York, and really for many, many years felt I really couldn't live anyplace else. It's also a state of mind. And when I lived in New York in the 70s, there was nothing easy about it. It was not a city that was as focused on money as it is now. It was a city that still welcomed all the disparate souls from every other town in the country where they didn't fit in, and really, really celebrated individualism. That was the New York that I knew. So that was a pretty special place. And I think, you know, I think being an individual counts for something still in New York City, but let's face it, money has changed the face of most of the large cities in the world, and New York is one of them. So I just think that there was tremendous opportunity in New York at that time, and opportunity to jump in and take risks and do different things. And so that's really the New York that I know.
You're listening to Literature Out Loud. That was today's guest, poet Celeste Gainey. Celeste, would you favor us with another poem?
Yes, I am going to read a poem, since we're still talking about New York, a poem that takes place on the set of Taxi Driver, and I was lucky enough to work for a bit on Taxi Driver. I didn't work the entire film, but you have to understand that at that time, there had never been any women working what we call below the line, in other words, in the technical areas of film, on a film set. There had never been a woman working, and I had been bugging the union to get me on a feature, and they mostly laughed at me. And one morning I got a phone call in my apartment, and it was the business manager of Local 52, my union, saying, "You still want your feature? Put on your jeans and get out to Brooklyn. You're going to go work on Dog Day Afternoon." So that was the first time there ever was a woman on the set below the line. And the second movie was Taxi Driver. And this is from my experience working on that film. De Niro idles in his checker. Sybil flirts behind her Jackie O's. Scorsese sucks oxygen from a tiny tank trailed by an assistant. Albert Brooks hogs the PA. "When using the moving sidewalk, please stand to the right. If you wish to pass, please do so on the left." Over and over. Grips lay dolly track for a shot we all know will never make the final cut, but will take most of the day to shoot. Me in my 501s and Mighty Mouse t-shirt, 20 feet up, work gloves and pliers protruding. The brute arc light I tend sputters and hisses beside me. Like that famous New Yorker cover showing the world as seen from 9th Avenue, the land of make-believe rises up to swallow me whole. I try to lean as if belonging against the unsteady rungs of my ladder, oblivious to the real world down there too, passing me by. Most jaded New Yorkers, their eyes on the prize, but maybe some looking up and wondering, "What's that girl doing up there in the sky, flying so close to the sun?" Some kind of myth with pliers.
Great punchline.
That was a wonderful poem. Great ending to that poem. And I like the idea of the evoking of myth in that poem, because your poems do have a kind of mythical quality. And I like their sort of bigness and how it's grounded in time and place and kind of historical things, in this case, in the movie Taxi Driver, and these other kind of iconic references that we hear.
I guess it's not surprising that light and the sun certainly seems to play a large role in your imagery and so on. Obviously, you've thought about light a lot. Say more about how it was that you felt that lighting chose you.
Well, you know, there was just so much energy around what I was around being a woman doing this thing at that time. And I was really fortunate when I was at NYU in film school, the last semester of my senior year, I spent working on a feature film that had nothing to do with NYU, but it was a feature film that was being shot by a woman who had money and connections, and she was going to direct this film that she had written, and she wanted an all-woman crew. And this was really quite something, and it was a very savvy move on her part because she realized that she would get a lot of publicity out of having this. And it was a woman's, you know, it was a film that was from a woman's point of view, you know, for a woman's audience. And so somehow she found me. They heard about the fact that there was this young woman who knew how to light. And so I worked on that film, and that film gave me a lot of exposure even before I had left school. So that energy of having worked on that film, which I got total credit for, graduated without ever being on campus the last part of that senior year. But it, there was just a lot of energy that pushed me out into that arena. And as I said, I just sort of followed it. And then what happened was I worked exclusively in film for about 10 years. And then I had a friend who had a restaurant. And he said, why don't you light my new restaurant? And I didn't think anything of it. I really did it as, you know, sort of like fun. And that one, that restaurant looked different from other restaurants, and it sort of caused a sensation. And so this whole new career opened up, which was also had its own energy, because we're talking now about the disco years. And one thing that the disco years brought to architecture was the idea of architecture as entertainment, because these clubs were so ornate and it had a lot to do with lighting. So you started to see theatrical stage lighting designers starting to light architecture, particularly spaces like restaurants and nightclubs and lounges and that type of thing. So there was this little opening and segue for me to come into architecture at that time. And so that I began to get more and more of those projects. I took a few design classes so I could learn to communicate on paper, because, you know, film is just the realm of finger pointing. As long as you get a light up there, and no matter how you get it up there, as long as it stays for the duration of the shot, that's all you need. But of course, when you do architectural spaces, you may actually be cutting a circle in that ceiling where a light will go and stay permanently, which is a completely, you know, different hurdle.
Yeah.
Right?
You reminded me actually of some years ago, a project here, and I remember none of the details really, but it consisted of projecting images using light at night onto existing buildings that completely transformed their facades. Mm-hmm. That was fascinating.
And I like the idea of, you know, cutting a circle in the ceiling and the idea of impermanence versus permanence, which I think is also very much prevalent in the work in this book, the two kind of coexisting side by side, which of course is what light is, right? There's an absence and a presence always of light. So to me, it though it may not appear to others, seems like a very natural sort of progression to poetry.
Well, I always like to say that the book is about light, but you know, it's about light in a very different way than you usually associate with poetry. Usually in poetry, you know, light is always the absolver, truth, beauty. I mean, there are these absolutes, positive absolutes that light represents. And really this book, which was pointed out to me by a wonderful Pittsburgh poet, Nancy Krakowski, this book is really about the problem of light. Light as a problem. This book sort of deals with light and is filled with light. But it's really about, you know, getting down to business with light. I mean, sometimes light is spoiled. Sometimes light won't do what you want it to do. You know, it isn't always perfect. So I think this book takes a different, you know, approach to the whole idea of light.
Yeah, I'm thinking about a line from one of the poems about, you read for our class today when you visited, about the bare bulb hanging down, this sort of harshness of light too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of looking at things truthfully.
Yes.
And going deep. And so I'd agree with Nancy.
Yeah.
It's a complicated
portrait
of light.
It is complicated, and I'm happy that that seems to be something that I can bring to the world of poetry, is to extend the metaphor.
And I actually think that problematic is introduced, now that you mention it, by the very first intro piece that you have there, where the actress is, you know, talking about the use of light to, you know, in a flattering way or whatever.
Right. You mean I Light Lucy?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. One of the first poems.
Yeah. One of the first poems. Yeah. I don't know how much time we have. I can certainly read that poem.
Great.
Okay.
And I would like to hear a... I always wanted a bird.
Okay. Let me see if I'm going to get back here.
We've got our favorites, too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, Celeste.
Thanks to both of you. It's been great. So this is a poem that came about because I did have the experience of lighting Lucille Ball at the end of her life. She came to New York to do some appearances, and she was very upset because whoever was in charge of taking care of her and setting up the situation where she could be made up and the lighting on the stage where she was going to speak and everything, none of this was done properly. And she was very upset. And I happened to be in the office of the president of the museum where Lucille Ball was doing all of making this appearance. And after he hung up the phone, because I could hear her in the room, seated on a couch, quite a ways away from him, I said to him, well, I think maybe I can help you out. I think I know what she wants. Because, you know, Lucy's a pro, okay? So you're going to hear a lot of lighting equipment being referenced in this film, but just don't pay. Just let it wash over you, because at the heart of it is Lucy. I light Lucy. I have the balls to know what she wants. Number 34, flesh pink, inkies, four of them. Key, fill, hair, obi. Diffusion on the key, bounce the fill, flag the hair, focus the obi hard, penetrate the eyes to glisten and mesmerize. Hair, a five alarm, lips of leaping flames, blue eyes burning through the bullshit. And the voice, by now, smoky, deep, demanding. Always make up in the best light, Lucy tells me, then demand the same for your close-up.
Great.
And then I think I'll close with I Always Wanted a Bird, which is right here. Sorry for the noise of my pages, everybody out there in Radio Land. But this is proof that there is a book.
The ruffling of pages.
Right. This is a poem, too, I Always Wanted a Bird. I just want to say before I begin that really came to me out of thinking about my first object of desire, the very first thing I can remember ever wanting, and that was a bird, and I did receive a bird for my third birthday. So this poem just sort of unfolds from thinking about that. I always wanted a bird, a sombrero, cowboy boots and button-up jeans like a boy, a coloring book history of the United States, a burro, not a donkey, a mother of pearl accordion, the ceremonial Indian headdress, the bamboo spear with the big rubber tip, the ochre dress with stripes going the wrong way. My father to stop drinking, my sister to protect me, my brother to disappear. A hickory deluxe burger and chocolate chip shake at Peterson's Drive-In, spare ribs and potato salad from Pupo's Delicatessen on my birthday. I always wanted a canary, the best grades in the class, white buck saddle shoes, Kennedy for president, to be a tennis champion, save my mother from my brother, be the governor of California, head of Time Inc., to not be fat, to be better at math, escape to boarding school, ride my bike casually, tan easily, and live on the beach at Malibu. In a penthouse at the Beverly Hilton, in the Monsanto House of Tomorrow at Disneyland, at the plaza like Eloise, to drink tiki punch at Trader Vic's, eat sweet butter on date nut bread at Bullock's Wilshire, Cobb salad at the Brown Derby. I always wanted a canary in a round silver cage, to fly first class, wear a tie and waistcoat, make money but not care, be famous, but not too, be the woman and man of my dreams, be born at the end of the 19th century, live in the demi-monde of Paris, the New York School in the 50s, La Nouvelle Vague in the 60s, to love someone as much as my mother, be like the lilies of the field, a pilgrim at the Ganges, to walk the sleepless streets of Greenwich Village, the groomed pathways of the Champ de Mars, the icy avenues of Reykjavik. Live in isolation, die sooner rather than later, erase myself. I always wanted a canary in a round silver cage, singing.
Beautiful. Wonderful.
That was Celeste Gainey reading from her new collection of poems, The Gaffer. I want to thank Celeste and my colleague Tess Berry for taking part in this episode of Literature Out Loud. Before we go, I want to remind our listeners to look for coverage of Celeste's new book, The Gaffer, in the April issue of O, Oprah's magazine, which hits the stands on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. And I'd also like to let listeners know how they can get a copy of The Gaffer, which is published by Arc Toy Books. How can they order a copy, Celeste?
Well, there is a website, Red Hen Press. Arc Toy Books is an imprint of Red Hen Press. And if they go online to redhenpress.org or just put in Google search Red Hen Press, the website will come up and my book is listed on that website. And the book is also available on Amazon. So it can be ordered on Amazon. It can be ordered on Barnes & Noble online. And it's available through the big independent, or not even independent, but just the big trade sellers distribution, Ingram. So you can even walk into your bookstore, and your bookstore should be able to order it for you.
Great. Thanks again, Celeste Gainey, for visiting us today with Tess and me.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Celeste. Wonderful to have you here, Celeste.
It has been. This has been Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine. I'm John Lawson. Thanks for listening.